Honorable, the judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit.
Thank you all. And we're ready for our, you can be seated. We're now prepared for the second case of the day. Tara Shuck versus Givens. And we have Mr. Lindemann.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good to have you with us, sir.
Good to be back here, Your Honor, in person. Mm-hmm. May it please the court, my name is Andrew Lindemann. I represent the appellants, Jamie Givens and Allison Harmon, who are two paramedics. Well, one's a paramedic, one's an EMT in South Carolina. Your Honors, this is undeniably a tragic case from a factual standpoint. There's no denying that. But what this appeal presents to this court are purely legal issues. What we have appealed is purely a second prong qualified immunity issue, which raises strictly legal issues for this court to determine precisely whether or not the legal duties that the plaintiff is claiming that these two paramedics had were clearly established by either United States Supreme Court law, Fourth Circuit law, or a broad consensus of other authority in September 2018. We submit that it did not, and that the trial judge or district judge erred in her analysis of the second prong of the qualified immunity analysis. This appeal asks basically two legal questions. Number one, and this is based on both the way the district court interpreted the plaintiff's pleadings as well as the plaintiff's specific allegations against the appellees Givens and Harmon. This appeal asks whether or not the law in this circuit was clearly established in September 2018, such that a paramedic would have known, an objectively reasonable paramedic would have known, been placed on fair notice of a constitutional duty to transport a mental patient to the hospital. And second of all, based upon the allegations that have been made by the plaintiff, whether or not it was clearly established in September 2018, whether a objectively reasonable paramedic would have known that there was a constitutional duty for the paramedic to intervene with law enforcement and prevent law enforcement removing the subject from the scene. Those are the issues that were specific.
So are you saying that those are the constitutional rights that on the first prong and that you don't contest those?
Well, the first prong was contested. Judge Childs found that there were factual
issues. Right, but you say in your briefs it's not an issue.
It's not an issue in this appeal because this is an interlocutory appeal and we can't challenge the sufficiency of the evidence under the Bertrand's case, if I'm pronouncing that right, and the Johnson case from the U.S. Supreme Court. So we're not conceding those issues because this is an interlocutory appeal under the Mitchell case. We cannot be challenging the first prong. So this appeal is limited to the second prong because that presents purely matters of law. And yes, to answer Your Honor's question, those are the constitutional duties that have been pled on page 74 of the record, paragraphs 282 and 283 of the plaintiff's complaint.
What about paragraph 280, where they say that defendants here were both deliberately indifferent to the decedent's obvious mental health needs in violation of agency policy by not taking them for a mental health evaluation?
Well, that's essentially a restatement of paragraph 282, which again, they're saying there was a duty to transport Mr. Tereshuk to the hospital for a mental health evaluation. That's reiterated in 280. So
paragraph 280 can't restate paragraph 282 because 282 comes after 280.
Well, I recognize that, but it's phrased in the same way. That the allegation there is that there was a a duty to take, right. This is from 280, to take Mr. Terrace right. to the hospital for a mental health event.
And that duty is the same one that we found existed in the Sintai case, correct?
The Sintai case?
Yeah, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong.
The Sintai case was obviously didn't involve paramedics, didn't involve anybody. Does that matter?
The right is about the pretrial detainee.
Well,
this was a pretrial detainee, correct?
Well, we dispute that.
No, you don't. You concede that in your summary judgment papers and in the consent order that he was in the custody of the deputy and also that he was a pretrial detainee.
One of the appellants does concede that for a first prong analysis. This is a second prong analysis. It's immaterial, I would submit, Judge Thacker.
Which one do you say concedes that? Harmon?
I believe it was Harmon who
okay.
approached the issue based upon it being a pre-trial.
What about in the consent order signed by Givens where she conceded that he was, quote, in the custody of the deputy when she arrived on scene?
Well, Your Honor, again, that is the facts of the case all go to the first prong. This is purely a legal question with the second prong. So what we're looking at, the second prong, I would submit right. what an objectively reasonable paramedic would believe. It's not a subjective standard.
So and the legal, but the legal issue is that a pretrial detainee is entitled to for the paramedics on the scene not to be indifferent to his medical needs.
It requires, yes, a pretrial detainee is, you must provide medical care to a pretrial detainee.
For our purposes today, we assume that it's a fact is given by the district court that with a legal conclusion that the decedent was a pretrial detainee.
Well, and again, that is, as Your Honor just said, it's a legal conclusion. In the footnote, in her opinion, Judge Childs relies on this case in Young versus City of Mount Rainier.
Isn't that a fact you have to accept? You have to accept that you can't be contesting that for purposes of this appeal.
Well, we're contesting it from a legal standpoint in determining whether the law was clearly established.
Well, you're talking about the clearly established law, but the fact he was a pretrial detainee, that's not a legal question.
I think it is, Your Honor. What the status of the individual is, I would submit, does present a question of law.
Okay. This incident happened in 2018, correct? All right. And in 2016, the Fourth Circuit in Cinto said the right of prisoners to receive adequate medical care and to be free from deliberate indifference to their known medical needs is a constitutional right at issue. That was 2 years before this. Before the incident. So how was it not clearly established for these EMTs?
Well, Cinto, first of all, was a prisoner case. It was a convicted prisoner case. It was under the Eighth Amendment. Number one. Number two, what the Supreme Court has said and said a number of times since Cinto in the Casella case is one that we've cited, that they admonished the circuit courts that the law is being looked at
right.
in too great a generality. And this is
there are two Supreme Court cases after Cinto that say that, but there are also Supreme Court cases before Cinto that say that. And Cinto is still good law, correct?
Cinto is good law, but again, it does not deal with a situation such as what we have in this case, where you're dealing with paramedics who are out on the scene. There's no arrest. The person is never taken into custody.
The person was in custody when they arrived on the scene. They took him out of a police car into the ambulance. He was in handcuffs.
By the time I believe that the paramedics got there, He was no longer in handcuffs.
But he was in the police car, in the custody of the police officer or the deputy.
Right. And there he was not under any type of criminal investigation. He was never.
But he was in custody.
Yes, he was.
That's what Judge Thacker asked you. If he wasn't in custody, you said yes.
That's correct. But again,
if you're in custody, you're a detainee. You're in custody. You're in custody. You're in custody.
That's correct. But what is important for this case is to look at what an objectively reasonable paramedic would have believed.
And you're saying it's a 14th Amendment standard rather than an 8th Amendment standard.
It is a 14th Amendment standard.
And you're saying there's a material difference between the two?
What I'm saying is you have to look at the specific facts. You have to evaluate the second prong of the qualified immunity.
But you have to give them the facts. The other side gets the facts for purposes of your interlocutory appeal.
And that's why, and again, that's
you can't be coming up here with a factual dispute on an interlocutory appeal for qualified immunity.
I totally agree with you.
Just the legal point, as you've said at the beginning, it's strictly law.
It's a legal point.
It's strictly law. And you characterize it in your statement of issue. You say the question is whether the decedent's 14th Amendment rights were not clearly established, such that paramedics in the appellant's position would have fair warning that their conduct toward the decedent was unconstitutional. That's the way you characterized it in your brief there, which is different than what you said here earlier this morning.
I don't believe so.
Maybe it's not materially different, but it's different terminology.
What I am suggesting this court is based on what the Supreme Court has cautioned in Casella and other cases. You have to look at the clearly established law with specificity.
Clearly establishes the right terminology. For
with
sure.
Specificity in this particular case, you have to look at whether there was a constitutional duty to transport Mr. Tereshchuk to the hospital. What's important to recognize.
Well, it seems like to me we're kind of going around in circles on pretrial detainee and whether or not Cento is the law. I mean, you have to accept that this individual was a pretrial detainee, or we have a very short argument today. And the same thing is, you may well be right that the level of specificity is too broad, but Cento is the law. That's the law that applies to our case, and that's where we go from here. So it seems like to me the first prong of the analysis, which you say you don't contest, deals with the constitutional right, which is stated to be deliberate indifference to his mental health evaluation. And then they give examples in the complaint. So the manifestation of what happened to make deliberate indifference to me that's not a separate constitutional principle. It's a matter of proving how the constitutional right was violated. Isn't that correct?
Well, Your Honor, the first prong is whether or not there's been a constitutional deprivation. And Judge Childs found that there are issues in fact and dispute that preclude a decision on summary judgment. So we haven't conceded any issues on the first prong. What we're saying is when you look at the second.
Right. I mean, you can go to trial and argue about whatever you want to, but for purposes of summary judgment, you're not contesting what the constitutional right is.
We are contesting whether or not the constitutional right that has been asserted and found to apply in this particular case.
You have to admit there was for purposes of your appeal, you need to admit that there was a constitutional violation, but say the right wasn't clearly established.
That is correct.
So, but you're trying to contest the constitutional violation.
I am not.
You are in your arguments. You keep saying they allege a constitutional. They have alleged. You, for purposes of your argument, they have a constitutional violation. The law wasn't clearly established.
Basing the constitutional right on what the district court said, which was based on the pleadings. And she said specifically, Tereshchuk alleges in his substantive due process rights under the 14th Amendment were violated specifically because defendants Harmon and Gibbons were deliberately indifferent to his serious medical needs by failing to transport him to a hospital and allowing Dorosky to take him from the ambulance. So the constitutional rights that are being asserted here is a constitutional duty to be transported to the hospital and a constitutional duty to intervene with law enforcement to prevent the law enforcement officer from removing him from the scene. That's the constitutional rights with the level of specificity that the Supreme Court requires. Those rights are not clearly established based upon United States Supreme Court law, this circuit's law, or a broad consensus of authority in September 2018. That is our position. And there have been no cases cited that support any type of clearly established principles during September 2018 that would support a finding that that constitutional right, as articulated, was clearly established. And I see my time is up. I'll continue on rebuttal. Thank you.
You've saved some time. Thank you, Mr. Linderman. Ms. Calloway?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Jordan Calloway, along with Russell Burke. We're here this morning on behalf of the appellee, Paul Tereshuk Sr. The way that the paramedics, Jamie Givens and Allison Harmon, interacted with Paul Tereshuk Jr. on the night of his death is the height of deliberate indifference. Despite reports of his bizarre behavior, they failed to take any minimal steps to address his mental health status. Instead, they shoved an ammonia stick up his nose and cursed at him. Harmon even described contemporaneously her indifference. She's caught on video specifically saying she'd rather be at home and sleep as opposed to dealing with his mental health crisis. Under the principles this court has established in Skinto and in other cases, ignoring, mocking, and abandoning a seriously ill detainee violates his substantive due process rights. Appellants argue today that they lack fair notice.
How do you frame the question of what the clearly established constitutional right needs to be?
Your Honor, it would be at the level that was found in Skinto, which is the duty to receive adequate medical care and be free from deliberate indifference to their known medical needs. So that applies to prisoners and applies just as much to pretrial detainees. I could cite for the court several instances where this court says that it applies both to detainees under the 14th Amendment to the same extent it does under the 8th Amendment to prisoners, and also that it applies to the same extent to mental health issues as it does to physical health issues. And so that is Fourth Circuit law. It's also been established in this circuit for a long time. And that is the law of Skinto. And that's really the issue here today. This is an argument against precedent that you're hearing from the opposing side. They're arguing that Skinto was wrongly decided. But I think they're also sort of suggesting that Skinto has somehow been impliedly overturned by Kilsa and Emmons. But let me address that for a second. Neither Kilsa nor Emmons said that Hope was wrong. And in Hope versus Pelzer, the U.S. Supreme Court said that you don't have to have a case that has the precise same facts. In fact, Hope rejected a standard that would require a case with materially similar facts. And Hope remains good law under Supreme Court precedent. Since Skinto has not been overruled by Emmons or by Kilsa, I also note one other thing about those two cases in particular. Those are Fourth Amendment excessive force cases. And in both instances, the Supreme Court said that phrase excessive force is of such that you do need maybe more specific facts there. But there's never been a Supreme Court or Fourth Circuit case which made a similar statement as it related to the deliberate indifference standard that applies to a detainee's serious medical needs. And so that is what makes those cases not necessarily different, but shows that they don't in any way even suggest that they impliedly overrule Skinto. Let me also say this about Skinto. Skinto was not writing on a blank slate. When they defined that right at that certain level, they did so because Eco versus Shreve had already done so. And the Fourth Circuit had already done so in a previous case. What they said in Eco versus Shreve is that you don't have to define the right of prisoner's right to be decontaminated from pepper spray after you've been sprayed four times, but instead you define the right as the right to receive constitutionally adequate medical care and for them not to be deliberately indifferent to that serious medical need. And so Skinto was not writing on a blank slate. It's also consistent with other Fourth Circuit precedent that we've cited in our brief, the Booker versus South Carolina Department of Corrections cases.
Well, as I understand your opposing counsel's argument, he says that he doesn't contest the general principle that a pretrial detainee there cannot be deliberate indifference to the medical needs of a pretrial detainee. But as I understand the argument, he says, when you look at what's clearly established, you look at the specific manifestation of what the deliberate indifference is. And here he says one of those examples is the quoting the complaint, the discontinuation of care and abandonment of the decedent without his consent and without providing further administration of care. And as I understand it, he's arguing that there, on that specific point, there isn't clear law at the time that the incident occurred. So what's your response to that, assuming I've characterized it correctly?
Your Honor, a couple. First of all, that Skinto, I believe, even on the facts, it establishes clearly, has clearly established law on that particular issue. Because think about one of the incidents that was in play in Skinto. This individual prisoner was having a medical emergency. He had bloody vomit and an issue of incontinence. And the prison doctor comes by, sees this, can visually see it. And as it was alleged by the prisoner, that he then looked at the prisoner with disgust and walked away. That is, he ignored the need, he effectively mocked the individual, and then he discontinued or abandoned him walking away. And that is precisely what we allege here, that these, or not what we allege, what the court found the record supports, that in this instance, these paramedics basically ignored the fact they knew he had bizarre behavior. They knew that he had all these other issues, but yet they didn't do any sort of minimal mental health analysis on him. Then they mocked him. The Dorofsky's video inside that ambulance is disturbing, Your Honor, to hear the things that they say to this man and how they mock him during their encounter with them. And then they do discontinue their care and just sort of walk away. So one, on Skinto, I think the facts, Skinto is actually a very good factual analogy for the case we have here. And so I think also if you look to other Fourth Circuit precedent.
Well, you've got two components, as I understand the law. This point, one is an objective analysis. Was it evident that there was a health problem? And I think there's a good argument when you look at the facts in the video that it would have been self-evident. Then it goes to the subjective factor. So what did the two defendants in this case know about it? Were they aware that this mental health condition was a factor and then acted regardless of that? So tell us what your best evidence is on the subjective factor.
Okay, yes, sir. I believe that it would be the fact that both of them admitted in their depositions and in their statements, in other words, that his behavior as described to them by Dorofsky was either bizarre or weird. Jumping on the tractor trailer naked, running around saying these crazy things, that was bizarre or weird. Then when you look to how the assessment they're supposed to do, they're supposed to determine if this person has altered mental status. Two of the factors of altered mental status include lethargy and bizarre behavior. And so by their own sort of standards, then they have to consider him to have altered mental status, which is a serious health need, both under their standing orders and under South Carolina law. We cite a South Carolina statute and regulation, both of which don't allow you to discontinue care when they're in a serious medical need like this. I would like to say one point about this, though. That subjective factor, I do believe, goes to the first prong of the qualified immunity analysis as to whether there was a constitutional violation. So under that 14th Amendment standard, you do have to show both the subjective and the objective standards in order to show that there is a constitutional violation. As I understand the appellant's position, they don't challenge that here. They're only challenging the clearly established element, that second prong. In fact, they were very effusive in their reply brief and sort of chastising me for even discussing that stuff in our brief, saying none of that's on the table. We're just dealing with clearly established here. And so I do think there's plenty of evidence in the record to support the district court's finding on the subjective element. But I also believe that that's not portion of their appeal as they've described it in their briefs.
Even if that wasn't given for our purposes today, if there's a factual dispute, that takes care of what we have to consider today, doesn't it?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Any factual dispute has to go to a jury, even on the qualified immunity question. And again, with the limited scope of interlocutory appeal for the denial of qualified immunity, they don't get to raise those here like anyway. And so that's just not on the table here today either. Let me mention a few other Fourth Circuit cases that I think would help.
They're trying to challenge your facts in this appeal. Does that undermine jurisdiction for the appeal?
Yes, sir. As we say in our jurisdictional statement, there is Fourth Circuit precedent, the Williams versus Strickland case, which discussed this, and Johnson, the Supreme Court case, which discussed this, which says that the court can deny or can dismiss the appeal, finding it lacks jurisdiction over those questions. Evidence sufficiency questions are not available in interlocutory.
So you have to get the benefit of the facts in order for them to get jurisdiction to argue the appeal.
Yes, we get the benefit of the district court's finding on the facts. They are limited in their arguments here, jurisdictionally wise. This court is.
Do you get the benefit of the district court's facts, or do you get the benefit, or you also get the benefit of the facts revealed in the record, viewed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff?
Yes, sir.
Is that in addition to what the district court found, or is that something different than what the district court determined? I'm just trying to get you to. Tell me what your position is.
Yes, sir. They are what the factual findings by the district court are consistent with the record. We would also get the presumption in our favor as everything that's in the record.
Well, the court was the court making findings, or was the court reciting the facts from the record in the light most favorable to the plaintiff?
I don't know if I perceive a big difference between.
I mean, usually findings. I see findings the judges make after they had a hearing or something and heard. Witnesses like on a suppression motion or something.
Yes, sir.
You didn't have anything like that here.
Yes, Your Honor. I think it's fair to describe that the court found the facts or considered the facts in the light most favorable to us.
Viewed them in the light most favorable to you and made the ruling, and they're contesting the ruling. And to do that, they have to accept the recitation of the facts.
Exactly, Your Honor. And that includes the fact that he was a detainee, which. They do basically concede. I mean, that's right in Harmon's briefing, that when she walked up with him, he was detained. Even if you look at the facts, we wanted to look in the facts of the light most favorable to us. When they walked up to him, he was in the back of the Rossi's car, which he describes as a transport cage. So he's in a cage when they find him. And then as they're walking into the ambulance, he begins to wander off. And then they, both the EMS and the police officer, says, no. And so if custody means that you're not able to go off on your own, we certainly have plenty of evidence of that in this case. I do want to address some of their arguments on clearly established, one of which is that the court can't consider any policy violations in the determination of clearly established law. Now, I will concede this much. Clearly established law cannot be based solely on policy violations. But there's both U.S. Supreme Court precedent and Fourth Circuit precedent considering policy violations in determining clearly established law. I would point the court to the Hope case and also this court's opinion in the Booker case. And in Booker, the court specifically said that policy violations can buttress finding a clearly established law in the precedent. And Hope said the same thing in considering policy violations to help a clearly established law instance. And there are plenty of policy violations here. In fact, I don't even think it's fair to necessarily call those policies. Those are standing orders on page 180 to 185 of the joint appendix. Each one of those has a signature of a doctor at the end of it. Those are standing orders that were allegedly ignored here by the EMTs. And that's important as it goes back to Skinto, because the other incident in Skinto was the denial of insulin, according to a doctor's standing order. So this inmate had insulin-dependent diabetes, and his blood sugar went up and down. And there was a sliding scale in the order as to how much insulin he was supposed to get based on his blood sugar reading. And the argument is that he should have gotten a certain amount and he didn't get any because this doctor denied it to him. And that is, in an instance, ignoring a doctor's order. That is precisely what we have here. Those standing orders in pages 180 to 185 are doctor's orders, and they ignored those. They just simply didn't follow them. As it relates to the determination of altered mental status and what you do with a person who has altered mental status. Then those standing orders are not just standing orders, they're also South Carolina law. We cited both a state statute and a regulation that supports those conclusions.
And for our purposes today, we assume all that to be factually given. Correct?
Yes, yes. Their misconduct, yes, is taken as a given for the purposes of today's hearing. Yes, sir.
I mean, y'all can argue about it all you want at trial, but for today's purposes, it's set.
Yes, sir. And that's supported by the record, and that was their allegations. Let me see if there's anything else here that we need to address. Your Honor, I took the court not necessarily accepted the argument that he was not a detainee, but I would be happy to go through all the case law that really does show that he was, in fact, a detainee, even if he was a non-typical detainee. They make a big deal out of the district court's footnote in the citation to Young. But if you look at Young and citation to note 5.
What do you mean they make a big deal?
Well, they point to the footnote in the district court's order, which says that Paul was not a typical detainee. And they interpret that.
What page is that on?
Well, isn't this a threshold issue? I mean, if there's a genuine factual dispute about detainee status, how do we have jurisdiction? I mean, that's not a threshold foundational question. What the right is?
Yes, sir, it is. And Judge King, to your question, the footnote is on page 2890 of the record, second or third last page of the district court's order. Young said even if he
what was footnote not, number was it?
Joint appendix, page 2890.
2890. Are you're giving me the JA thing? I'm looking at the opinion. All right. Page 16. 17.
Footnote 13.
All right.
And that's Young. And if you look at Young footnote 5, they said even if that individual was a non-typical pretrial detainee, same duty was owed to him. That is to say, as soon as he was taken into custody by state authorities, whether that was done for criminal investigatory purposes or for some other purpose, they still had a duty to provide him constitutionally adequate medical care that is not deliberately indifferent to a serious medical need. Now, as I understand the reply brief, their position simply is, well, what makes Young different is that and Young, it was the officer's conduct which created the need for medical treatment. And that Young does not make that distinction. But I also note that Young cites Buffington. And in Buffington, the court says basically the exact same thing. But in Buffington, the reason the person was taken into custody, civil custody, is because he was suicidal. And so once they took him into custody, they had a duty to provide minimally adequate medical care for him, which is in that instance was just to monitor him. But my point is, in Buffington, they certainly didn't create an obligation. They still had an obligation to provide constitutionally adequate medical care to him. And so this notion that Young is just limited to instances where the officers create the need for medical care just doesn't hold up to the case law. And so we've got plenty of cases to establish that. You know, I'd also note there are, by defining these two rights, this notion that it's just about transporting to the hospital, just about intervening with Dorofsky, that is not the limitations on our claim. If you look at paragraph 280 of our complaint, we allege 10 different ways in which Harmon and Givens were deliberately indifferent to his medical needs. That includes elements of the assessment itself. Like, for example, they acknowledged that they falsified the record afterwards and said that he was alert times 4. And they not only didn't determine that, they didn't even ask the questions or all the questions you would need to determine that. They asked him his name, sure. And I think they perhaps asked what he was doing out there that night. But alert times 4 means that you're alert to person, place, event, and one more that I'm forgetting. But they didn't even ask all questions to even address all 4 of those things. And so when you're talking about a minimally adequate, constitutionally adequate analysis, they didn't even ask the questions. We haven't even talked this morning so far about their misuse of the ammonia stick, which they stick up his nose for several minutes in violation of every way in which they were trained. They admit they misused that. And then they said that he would have to give their name, his name, before they'd even remove it from his nose. That, too, constitutes deliberate indifference. Remember, under the 14th Amendment, no pretrial detainee can face any form of punishment. That could very easily be determined to be a punitive action, the way they were using that ammonia stick. We haven't even got to the DHEC orders, where they admit to all of these things. They admit that they didn't do the proper
assessment. They got to the what orders? I didn't understand.
The DHEC consent orders.
Oh, the agency?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay.
Where they each acknowledged that they're subject to discipline. They ended up being suspended for these things. They admit that their assessment was improper. And they admit that they didn't misuse the ammonia stick. They admit that they misrepresented these things in the records. They admit that they abandoned their patient. We have Fourth Circuit case law, which says that if you ignore, mock, and abandon your patient, that qualifies as deliberate indifference to a substantial medical.
You say they falsified the records too?
Yes, sir, they did.
What's the impact of the falsification of records in a 1983 case?
Your Honor, I think it does help support the notion that they were deliberately indifferent. I know it's after this case, but the Fifth Circuit considered a case just last year, the Kelson case, where they noticed these very same things. They falsified the records and found that that, at least at the complaint stage, supported the notion that they were deliberately indifferent. If they're going to cover it up afterwards, it would suggest that that they were acting deliberately when they performed the act that was misconduct in and of itself.
So it goes to proof of the deliberate indifference.
Yes, sir. I see my time is about up. If there is no additional question.
You don't have to take it all if you don't want to.
Mm-hmm. Or we would ask the
but
court.
But you're entitled to it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. We appreciate it. Mr. Lindemann.
May it please the court. Your Honor, Mr. Calloway points to paragraph 280 of the complaint suggesting that there were additional constitutional duties or issues at play in this particular case. I would remind the court that this was a substantive due process claim. If you look at some of those particulars, they talk about discriminating against him. That's not a substantive due process claim. Mocking the subject, again, mocking has never given rise to a constitutional.
Well, that'd go to prove in the deliberate indifference, just like falsifying records.
Absolutely. It would go to a first prong issue. Again, we are bringing a second prong appeal here because, again, that is all that we can appeal because that is a legal issue. And what we focused on is what the district court found. And the district court found, this is on page 16 of her order, that the plaintiffs alleged that Harmon and Givens were deliberately indifferent to his serious medical needs. She says, quote, by failing to transport him to a hospital and allowing Dorosky, the deputy, to take him from the ambulance. Those are the issues that she ruled upon at summary judgment. And those are the issues.
The sentence is actually that's what he alleges that you just read.
That's right. And that's what.
I thought I heard you say that the court found that.
No, that's what she is focused on.
No, she says that's what he's saying.
That's correct.
She didn't say that's what I'm saying. I'm talking about the she there who's Judge Childs.
And her clearly established law analysis.
May well be right, but that's what, but it's not her. It's not her saying that's what the issue is. It's their claim that that's what the issue is.
And that's what she addressed at summary judgment, Your Honor. And so the point being, we're not arguing that Skinto should be overturned. Skinto is a...
Why are you saying it wasn't clearly established, that the constitutional right was not clearly established?
Not clearly established because you have to look at the right with specificity that the Supreme Court requires. You have to look at whether there's a constitutional right to transport him to the hospital.
You're saying there's never been a case like this?
There's never been
a case. It might ever be another one, as weird as this.
Additionally, Judge King, there's no law in South Carolina that authorizes.
I hope there's never another like this.
You're saying that it was not clearly established to Harmon and Givens that what they did was wrong.
That's right.
Then why did they falsify the records?
That, from a constitutional,
they must have known it was wrong. Why would they falsify the records?
Well, again, that's an allegation that they falsified the records.
Well, I thought they conceded they falsified the records. They, in the consent order, they admitted they falsified the records.
Judge Thacker, there's a
difference. And you admit that for purposes of this appeal?
For purposes of a prong one argument, yes. But
there
the
you
point
go.
Being, those issues also go to state law claims. There's state law claims involved in this case. I mean, that's a standard of care issue. That's a medical malpractice issue. Those are all state claims. The focus of this case is whether or not there's a constitutional right that has been violated, number one. And number two, if there is a constitutional right, whether it was clearly established. And the right that they're claiming is a right to have been transported. There is no law that supports that. Neither South Carolina's statutory law supports that. Mr. Calloway keeps arguing that there is, but Your Honors, 44-17-410.
No, he's they're saying that there was deliberate indifference. And that the part that you read to his serious medical needs by failing to transport, that right. There was deliberate indifference.
There's no legal right to transport him in September 2018. There cannot be a constitutional deprivation based on a failure to transport. There's no law that allows for it, that supports it. The case law that we submitted, including the cases out of the Seventh Circuit, the Payne versus Kaysen and the Salazar case, support our position. And as I was just indicating to the court, South Carolina has a very specific statute that satisfies procedural due process about how you can emergency admit a mental patient. And it does not provide for a paramedic to have that authority. It only allows for a court to have that authority after certain procedural aspects are taken care of. So what they're arguing that we didn't do, we couldn't have done legally. So therefore, it can't support a constitutional claim of deliberate indifference.
So again, is your argument under South Carolina law, if the two defendants in this case had looked at this individual there in the ambulance and said, you know, there's obviously a mental episode here, or he wouldn't have been riding the tractor trailer naked down the interstate in the middle of the night. We're going to take him to somebody who knows more about mental health than we are in order to try to assess the situation. Are you saying if they just drove the ambulance with him in it to a hospital that he had a legal cause of action against them for abduction or
false
imprisonment?
Yes, Your Honor.
What?
Quite frankly, if the officers had arrested him, that'd be a different story.
Wait, don't their own...
placed under arrest. The paramedics have no right to arrest.
Don't their own protocols say that paramedics are required to transport someone with an altered mental state to the hospital under implied consent?
That is an Orangeburg protocol.
Right, that's what I said.
Yeah, it's not law.
Right, but their own protocol, so they don't have to follow their own protocols?
Constitution, that does not give rise to a constitutional duty.
Do they have to follow their own protocols?
I would submit that it's contrary to state law, Your Honor.
So they don't have to follow their own protocols?
That's a position that I certainly would take on that particular issue, but that is a state law issue that goes to the state law claims for which Judge Giles deferred any type of ruling. So when we focus purely on the Constitution, the United States Supreme Court, as well as this court in Law versus South Carolina Department of Corrections, have made it clear that a violation of policy, this isn't even a policy, this is a protocol.
Well, what's
written
protocol and a policy sound to me like the same thing.
Well, I mean, bottom line is, that does not give rise.
Well, they argue, he argued that the law, that policy violations are relevant on the clearly established issue.
Well, they're not, Your Honor.
And you say they're not.
Look at Law versus South Carolina Department of Corrections. Look at the Caressi's case from the United States Supreme Court. They've spelled that out pretty clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And then on this whole idea of intervening, having a duty to intervene and stop law enforcement from taking this guy away and releasing him, paramedics don't have that constitutional duty.
Ms. Harmon might as well stay asleep then. Under your theory, she wanted to go back to sleep. Was she the one that wanted to go back to sleep? She might as well stay asleep, not even come out and bothered with this gentleman, because she didn't have to follow any protocols.
I am not suggesting that, and that's for another day, whether or not the plaintiffs have a remedy under state law. The question before this court is whether or not it was a constitutional duty under substantive due process, either transport or intervene with the police officer, and our position is that law was not clearly established. We're not suggesting, standing here saying, that the plaintiffs will or will not prevail on a state law claim. State law torts are obviously available to address these type of issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lindemann. And we appreciate the arguments of counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement and determined. We would normally at this time rise from the bench and go into the well of the court and greet counsel. And thank you personally, but we will, we're not doing that these days. We hope to be doing that the next time you come. But we thank you very much. It's good to have you here. Thank you for your work.